Well, first and foremost, thank you for inviting me. So the story that I'm about to tell you about today is a rather surprising finding. It's this observational constraint that indicate that when two neutron stars merge, some of the matter that they eject out has this very spherical shell that's being thrown out. The talk itself is very much focused on observational constraints. I'm going to show you how we can try to probe the geometry of this explosion. I'm going to try to show you why this constraints are relatively robust. And I'm going to maybe argue what are the difficulties in this problem. That all goes very much to the observation sides, even though most of this, of course, pertains to the very interesting and somewhat unresolved problem of how do you actually generate such a spherical explosion. So this talk is very much focused on the observations, and I will a few times ponder about what this actually means for the theory, both in the beginning and towards especially the end. I should emphasize that while I get to give this talk, I've listed all my nice co-authors here. They all contributed greatly. I'm just lucky enough that I get to present here. So thank you for giving me this option. So this story, as many other stories within multi-messenger astronomy, starts with a gravitational wave detection 170817. I'm showing you here the signal that we got from LIGO. It's this beautiful signal, you know, this chirp in frequency, where you can see the two stars as they coalesce in towards each other. I just want to emphasize here the y-axis that we're looking at, right? We're talking about frequencies in the final seconds before of a few hundred hertz. So given the physical size of this system, you know, the size of the neutron stars, we're talking about them rotating at a sizable fraction of the speed of light, coalescing, crashing into each other, and what happens in this collision. At least some of this that happens immediately afterwards is some of the matter is ejected away. And this is very heavy atoms. It's radioactive, so it's very luminous. And so this great series of observing campaigns looked up in the night sky, and within a tiny piece of the area that the gravitational wave had localized the signal to be originating from, this flicker of light was found in the galaxy that we call NGC 4993. It's these few pixels here that light up and flare up, the data that I'll be talking about in this presentation. And in this light is encoded the story of this matter that's being ejected in the collision. Okay, so the fundamental thing to get across here is that the geometry of expansion is uniquely predicated by the merger physics that go into this. So here I'm showing you three example numerical simulations made by different groups, kind of with slightly different physics, but into them. The overall narrative is the same, right? Two objects rapidly rotating. Is the sound coming across okay?
Yeah.
Brilliant. Okay. Two objects rapidly rotating around each other. The large angular momentum means that we almost have a cylindrical symmetry to the system, but certainly there is no generic expectation of a spherical symmetry of this matter being thrown out. Now, solving the problem of how this explosion exactly looks is rather hard. It involves a lot of different areas of research, right? It's both, you know, an unknown equation of state. It's also at the gravitational limit where we have to start considering the GR of it all. Then you put in the fact that, you know, we're talking about magnetic fields at a level where you have to understand the very, you know, nonlinear magnetohydrodynamics. And then on top of that, we maybe have the problem that we believe that some of this matter being thrown out is sensitive to the neutrino physics of it all, where neutrinos can irradiate and throw out little spouts of ejecta. And so this complicated problem is kind of at the intersection of many disciplines. And so from first principles, from numerical simulations, it's not at all obvious how this explosion is going to look. But I'm fundamentally going to argue that this problem of how do neutron stars look when they merge is interesting for two reasons. One is this question of the extreme physics at the heart of this merger. So it gives us a probe of this extraordinary physical regime. And the second reason why you ought to be interested in this problem is because it offers us a complementary point of view. That is to say, the formation of the heaviest elements of the periodic table, the R process elements, those are all, or in a large part, believed to be produced in the merger of neutron stars. So here I'm showing you kind of that a nice canonical simulations. It's the chart of the isotopes, and the x-axis the number of neutrons, and the y-axis the number of protons. And in these kind of very unique environments around neutron stars, you can kind of bombard your way up the periodic table by bombarding neutrons onto you. And that's in and of itself, as a small digression, a very interesting problem, right? Where do the periodic table of the elements comes from? I mean, you can explain the lightest elements quite easily, hydrogen, helium from the Big Bang, and then you know, in the fusion processes of stars or in core collapse supernovae or thermonuclear supernovae, you can run a bit further up the periodic table. But really, to explain the abundances we see of the very heaviest elements in the periodic table, it seems that we now believe that the major site may be neutron star collisions. And I'm trying to emphasize this on these two plots here, that on the top you see the solar system abundances of the distant elements, and on the bottom you see what is produced by the odd process. And so if we want to explain the elements, you know, in the bottom here, strontium and so forth, we really have to go and understand this explosion. As an interesting point of fact, I'll just point out that as of right now, we only actually have one identification of an R process element synthesized in the universe, and that's from this gravitational wave detection, and that's the detection of strontium in the merger. And so there are these kind of two fun perspectives, the extreme physics at play at the heart of the merger and the story of the synthesis of the heaviest elements, but they both feed into one another, because as I'll show you, this identification of strontium, this identification of the heaviest elements, allows us to probe this beautiful geometry of the explosion, which allows us to probe the extreme physics of the merger, the extreme physics of the merger telling us exactly which elements are going to be synthesized. So it kind of circles around itself. But at the heart of this is this fundamental question, the question of what is the geometry of expansion? So there are many different physics that come into play, right? The most obvious and immediately apparent one is the fact that when you have two bodies rotating rapidly around each other with a huge gravity, there's going to be a large tidal force acting on them. And that means that all the models kind of predict that when the two coalesce, there'll be a tidal tail of matter that's liberated due to the large angular momentum. It's predominantly in the plane of the disk. And so that allows us one kind of way to throw out matter, and that happens on a dynamical timescale, and is then supplemented by the other methods. So we're also going to have the two bodies slamming into each other. Now there's going to be a sharp interface, and on another on the same dynamical timescale, a matter may be spurring out from this shock of the collision. And so adding to the complexity, then, as we go deeper or a few seconds later, then we want to understand, well, the two stars, originally two neutron stars, coalesce. They are going to collapse and form a black hole. Their combined mass is above the TOV mass of a neutron star, so they're not in and of themselves stable, but they may have an intermediary stage supported by their kind of, as the two aggregate together, by their differential rotation or their solid body rotation, the stars may hold up for a while. And so what this hypermassive or supermassive neutron star does to the system is really rather unknown. And so does that mean that the magnetic fields, so the energy associated with that, can permeate out and throw out more mass? What does it mean when you try to add neutrinos into it? Because they are believed to irradiate and throw out more matter. And so we have all of these different pieces. It's very hard to understand from first principles or from theory. So let's try to jump into some observations and see what they tell us, and then we'll end up back at this at the end. And the first thing I want to note is actually there are one prior way to get nice geometrical constraints for kilonovae. And it's kind of detailed for this object by Covino et al. In 2017, and that's that you try to look at the polarization of light. The problem is that it's not a super sensitive framework, and in this case, the only thing that was determined was that the relatively weak intrinsic polarization that was observed was exactly identical with the polarization of the field stars along that direction. So it's just consistent with the galactic dust within the Milky Way scattering and creating that degree of polarization. But there is this hope that maybe for future objects, if we get enough and they have a large enough degree of asphericity, that would be detectable using polarimetry of the light. But I'm going to suggest that there is another framework, there is another piece of analysis that's actually hiding this story of the geometry of the explosion. And to do that, we really have to delve into this optical counterpart of the kilonova, the light that it contains and the information hiding in it. So here I'm showing to you on the left this story of the photometry, how they evolve across time. So the y-axis here is time, and the x-axis here there. Is the flux, and you kind of see how it fades away, the reddest colors being the slowest to fade. In the right-hand plot here, you see it in a bit more detail. Here you see the beautiful spectrum taken with a very large telescope by ESO, where you can kind of see this kind of beautiful black body that's pristine in the early epochs. So when I say epochs, the first really nice spectrum we have is taken 1.4 days after the merge, and then every subsequent epoch, we look a day later into the ejecta and how it's kind of fades away. And it should be noted that the way it fades away in subsequent days, that in and of itself is a characteristic signature of being a kilonova. But hiding within the story of this light is embedded the story of the geometry. And the argument that we make in this paper is that we have two kind of complementary points of views to this explosion. Now, the first is the fact that the continuum is very well modeled by a black body. And you kind of see this beautifully here in Watson et al.'s paper in 2019, that you have this kind of black body that works all the way from the ultraviolet to the near infrared that we've been able to probe at 2.2 microns. And I want to emphasize that, like, from a first principles point of view, the papers that came before these observations didn't predict that the observations would be a black body. It's actually really hard for radiative transfer models to reproduce this black body. And it's currently a bit hard to understand how you get these nuclear synthesis yields, and it shouldn't deviate you greater from a black body. But again, these observations just show that it is a very, very pristine black body. And I'll get to why a bit later. I'm also writing a paper on the arguments for this, but it's very nice that you see this kind of shape. It's well fit by a black body, except there are these two locations where it isn't. And there is a reason for that, and that's because it's a black body, but it's modified especially by this P-Cygni profile of an element strontium. And the fact that it's strontium itself is perhaps not too large a surprise when one thinks about it, because strontium is not only one of those elements that has to be very abundant in the synthesis of heavy elements in neutron star collisions. It's not only abundant in the sun, it's also an element which in its low-lying energy levels are very accessible in the local thermodynamic equilibrium of this kind of characteristic temperatures and densities. But on top of that, it has three really strong resonance lines, which means that it has this very strong feature around 1 micron where it kind of has absorption blue of that and this emission peak around that. And Watson et al. Was the first to note that now we actually have this spectroscopic identification, but a lot of people have that piled on, Domoto et al., Gilandes, Vieira, all kind of adding to the story of the strontium identification. But the neat thing for us here to keep in mind is the story of where the strontium is actually absorbing the light from, right? Because the strontium resonance lines themselves are located right around 1 micron. And as you can see here, the absorption actually goes all the way down to about 700 nanometers. And that's to say that at least the most blue shifted part of the strontium is moving out towards it as 30% the speed of light. And so the idea here is that in the wavelength stratification of this line is detailed for the velocity stratification of the strontium. And it's a very generic idea, really, well motivated by previous analyses of P-Cygni profiles in other fields of supernovae, for instance. It's this idea that if you have this banding atmosphere, then along your line of sight, light will be scattered out, and that's going to be blue shifted because the matter's moving out at a sizable fraction of the speed of light. And orthogonal to your original line of sight, there's matter that's light that's then being scattered into your line of sight, creating this emission peak. So you get this very characteristic feature, an absorption trough followed by an emission peak. And so within that feature is hiding the velocity stratification of the material, how fast all of this is expanding out. Okay, so here's my statement. It's going to be rather silly, but it fundamentally goes like this. So the expanding photosphere method was originally developed for supernova type 2Ps, and it's rather simple. You assume a black body spectrum, then you assume homologous expansion from some point in time. And if that's true, right, we can infer the velocity this is expanding out from the strontium line. We can infer how long ago it's been expanding because we know the gravitational wave and we know when we're measuring, right? So we know how large this system is physically. And if it truly is a black body, then it has an intrinsic luminosity to it, which means we can compare that to the flux we observe and infer the distance to this object. Or conversely, I can assume the distance to this object, and then I can start comparing these different metrics, right? So the statement here is, if it really is a black body, right? If it truly is a black body, then For the area it has, the intrinsic luminosity, given the distance to us, is yielding us the area we're seeing in the night sky. So to put this more graphically, here on the right, you're seeing the plot. And depending upon what velocity I assume for the system, I'd either get something with a larger area that's more luminous or a smaller area that's less luminous. So this is just saying that the luminosity of the thing is encoded in the size here. The luminosity of the thing follows from the area that's emitting. And also, we have this constraint on the velocity of the line. And the line itself is rather well constrained, right? Because you can see here, I can move it up 1% of C, or I can make it slower 1% of C, but that really misses where the strontium is absorbing the light. And so we have these two constraints, one, the area we see in the night sky, and two, how fast it's moving towards us. And they're entirely independent thing from different parts of the spectrum, right? And the neat thing in the paper, as we show, is that this green line going through the data of the large panel, this green line going through the continuum of the spectrum, that's not a fit to the data. That follows from the velocity of the strontium. So that's to say, if you assume the velocity of strontium, then you infer the correct cross-sectional area. Okay. Let's try to spell that out in a kind of more mathematical sense. If we define what I here will call an asymmetry index, epsilon, I take the difference of the velocities over their sum. So if this thing is entirely spherical, we should get an epsilon index of around zero, that the two velocities match. And so what it turns out is, for the standard assumptions of how far away this object lies, right, and we know pretty exactly where it lies because we know what galaxy this object resides in, then here, depending on the x-axis, on what distance you assume to the object, you can infer how well these two velocities fit to each other. And the takeaway here is, for a Planck cosmology, or for that matter, for Schuh's cosmology, you get this answer where the two velocities are in very near agreement. And they're in very near agreement in all the epochs that we're probing, epochs 1, 2, and 3, which are different days, right? Here's the thing, right? Just to spell this out, you look at the spectrum that has a continuum, you can model that luminosity. You can model the line that has a velocity, that's fine. We can fit all of these properties and we can get the temperature as a function of each epoch. And we can get the size of this thing as a function of each epoch. And the inferred velocity from the area in the night sky and along the line of sight match in all epochs, even though they're both changing across time. Which means that in the language of the expanding photosphere method invented by Bard and Kirchner, we're getting a consistent distance to this object. We're getting a distance of about 44 megaparsecs, which is exactly where this galaxy is expected to be, right? So what I'm saying here is that the fact that these two velocities are in agreement in each epoch is a really hard thing to get by coincidence, because it means that the velocity of the strontium line is receding inwards at exactly the same rate as the velocity of the black body thermalization radius. Okay, so that's the key part. Now, let's try to dig into this argument. Let's try to find out the strength of this. Now, I'll argue that there are four reasons why I think kilonova are actually really nice to use, or terrain to use the expanding photosphere method. The first is this idea that we have a gravitational wave prior, right? We know exactly when this event happened. We know when we got the GRB a second afterwards. So we know when the collision happened. And when people do this analysis on supernovae, they don't know when exactly the time of the supernova is, so they have to fit across multiple epochs. That's uncomfortable for two reasons. One, it means that all your epochs are no longer statistically independent, right? You can't test internal robustness because one epoch is now related to every other epoch. But two, it's uncomfortable because you just introduced a huge systematic that's very hard to constrain, i.e. the time of explosion. We don't have that problem because we know when this collision happened down to the second, and we know how this expansion starts in such a short time scale that within a second, this is just really expanding out.
Albert?
Yeah.
What is EPM?
What, sorry?
EPM.
Oh, sorry. That's this term that I invented before. I was saying it's the expanding photosphere method.
Oh, okay.
It's this idea of the photosphere expanding outwards. But yes, thank you so much for asking. That's a very important question.
How do you estimate the two velocities of this ratio from observations?
So the idea here is that the spectrum, right, it has, if we jump back to this plot, here, that you can infer the area of the thing, like the lumen, the black body normalization is set by the area of the thing modulo the distance to the object. We know which galaxy this resides in. It's NGC 4993, and it's about at a distance of 42 megaparsecs. It's like 44 if you assume Planck cosmology, 41 if you assume shoes. And so we know how far away it is. And so the normalization itself is set by the luminosity, by the size in the night sky.
So I'm trying to catch up to you. So here, when you say here, I see three plots, I see an equation. So what is here? Where should I be looking at? Maybe if you use your pointer, it may help.
Oh, can I do this?
Yes,
that's a great question. So this is good. So can you see this plot here, this continuum that I'm highlighting?
Yes.
Okay, great. So the idea here is that the different lines here going from blue to red is assuming different areas of the thing in the night sky. Different areas give different intrinsic luminosities. And we can always relate areas to velocities because we know how long it's been expanding from the gravitational wave signal.
So just this, can I ask, that's areas, what, but it also, I mean, can I not change it by assuming a different effective temperature?
You can change it by assuming a different effective temperature, but then the temperature you fit is gonna change the shape of the black body, which means you're gonna get, you know, an error either on the UV end or on the infrared end. So the idea here is that the temperature is constrained by the shape of the spectrum. And but you're right, there's a degeneracy in this landscape, and that's one to be careful of. That was a really good question. The point is, one of these velocities is a statement of how large this thing is in the night sky, inferred from the black body normalization. And the other velocity is inferred from the characteristic velocity of the line that you get, because you know the rest wavelength of the line, because you know it's these three resonance lines of strontium. And so comparing how fast it's moving towards us and how large it is in the night sky gives us these two velocities, the perp and the perpendicular. V perp and V parallel. Does that seem reasonable?
Good, thank you.
Maybe I can ask another question while we're stopped. So, I mean, here you're showing that the velocities are very close to each other, but do you have any statistically significant measurement of the differences between them for these epochs, or it's all consistent with speed zero?
So for all these early epochs, you know, for Planck cosmology, they're all within one sigma of zero. For shoes, they're, you know, one and a half. So, I mean, they're not, for all epochs, they're kind of consistent. I think there might be evidence of a slight trend if you look 1, 2 to 3, and I'll touch on that a bit later. But the point is just every data set we've applied this to, it's consistent with epsilon of zero. Oh, very near. Okay. But that's a nice question as well. Okay, so I was trying to turn on why would kilonovae be a nice place to use this expanding photosphere method? And one of them is the fact that we know the time of the explosion from the gravitational wave prior. And the second is the fact that we know that we get this really beautiful temporal follow-up, right? Where we are watching this explosion 10 hours and, you know, 1.4 days after the explosion. So we could watch this black body while it's still pristine and really easy to fit. And as you go deeper and deeper, as the photosphere kind of recedes, and as you go into what's called the nebula phase, it becomes very hard to do this kind of analysis. And so this framework only worked because of a really amazing serving campaign. The third reason why we get such a nice constraint here, and this might be a bit obvious, but it's just because we're dealing with so large velocities. So when people have done this with supernovae have a much smaller characteristic velocity, right? They're moving at a, you know, 10 times slower than this ejector. And so the ratio of your uncertainty and your velocity to your velocity has just been tweaked by, you know, a factor of 10. And so you can constrain the velocity relatively far better. And the fourth reason, which I think is rather subtle but worth mentioning, is this idea that it turns out that electron scattering is really negligible in this environment. And I've always, in this argument, kind of been equating the idea that there is a thermalization radius of the blackbody with whatever the photospheric radius of the line is. And that's not really an obvious argument to make. Indeed, if I was in an environment where there was a bunch of opacity there, typically we associate that opacity with being from electrons, then the radius of the photosphere could be pushed out relative to the radius of the blackbody. And so it would be hard to make this equality hold. The neat thing for us, which I first actually realized because of my referees on this paper, is the fact that in this environment, electron scattering is completely negligible. And so while it's a huge systematic for supernovae that can change the results by a factor of 20% in distance or in sphericity here, for us, it's negligible for two reasons. One, there are far fewer electrons per mass of the nucleons, right? We're far, far further down the periodic table, and we're not that highly ionized. So the mass of the nucleons per the number of electrons have just been, you know, dropped by a factor of 10 or an order of magnitude and a half. And adding to that is the fact that the continuum opacity, the bound-bound opacity of the lines is so much higher in this environment than it was in the supernova environment. And that means that basically you have these really complex atoms, right? The lanthanides, and their bound-bound opacity is so high that electron scattering is really truly negligible. And so the largest systematic in the problem kind of goes away just because of the physics. It can kind of be exemplified by looking at this plot here. And here on the left, I'm showing you a supernovae that people like to fit to a blackbody. And here on the right, I'm showing you the kilonovae. And I think it's rather apparent that maybe the supernovae is not a hugely great fit to a blackbody, but the physical environment of the kilonovae is. Okay. And so this is just one closed narrative on itself, right? We have two ways of measuring velocity. One is the radius of a blackbody, and the other is the radius of the line. And we can compare those two radii, and we can see radii, and we can see that the velocity is in agreement. That this explosion is close to spherical. Okay. I'm going to argue that there's another way to do this, and it's far more sensitive to systematics. So you ought to be relatively skeptical of what I'm about to say. But in theory, there is information hiding within this data that could tell us the geometry of this explosion. Concretely, what I'm talking about is when you look here at the blackbody residual, when you look at the line itself, right, that has a shape to it. It has an absorption trough, and you can kind of see the transition of the line. And that shape of the line is encoding where the strontium is around this explosion, right? If you had a prolate density distribution of strontium or a very oblate density distribution of strontium, those two distributions have different source planes, different initial specific intensities, different optical depths, and so they have different shapes. And so the transition from the absorption trough to the emission peak are wildly different. And so in theory, you can actually fit the geometry from the shape of the line. And so as a kind of addendum to the paper, we tried doing that. And I want to really emphasize that this way of viewing it is entirely orthogonal to everything I've said before, because before I was just asking, can I fit the central velocity of the line? Now I'm asking, can I fit the shape of the line and infer the geometry? The thing is that Hoefling et al. In 1997 had this really nice paper that proves that you cannot do this analysis. Fundamentally, you're dealing with this problem that you have too many degrees of freedom, right? You can take a spherical explosion and you can get an absorption or P Cygni profile from that. And you can take an aspherical explosion and just tweak the inclination angle to be just so it looks exactly like the spherical explosion. This is what you see in this plot here. The dotted line is the spherical explosion. The dashed line is the aspherical explosion. And you really can't tell them apart, because you can just freely choose exactly your inclination angle so the two systems look alike. And this is also what I'm showing here in synthetic analysis, that on a generated P Cygni profile where we know every parameter that goes into it, I have this huge degeneracy between how aspherical is my system and what viewing angle I'm looking at it on. So really you cannot constrain a system if you don't know what your viewing angle of the system is from the shape of the line. Of course, the nice feature is we do know what viewing angle we're looking at this feature from. We have very long baseline interferometry as presented in Mouly et al. 2017. We have Hubble precision astrometry as presented in Mouly et al. 2022. And so we actually know that we're looking at this system about 22 plus or minus 3 degrees from the polar direction. And I guess, I mean, to a lesser extent, we also have the gravitational wave signal. And so the idea here is, given all of these constraints on where we're viewing this explosion, we could fit it as a series of different geometries, you know, trying to vary the ellipticity of it all. We could have a very spherical explosion, a very prolate, very oblate, and we could see what geometry, what the shape of the lump are. And as it turns out, if you apply this mathematical framework, Unibauer's code and all, to this data set, you get this really nice answer again, that the line asymmetry, the ratio of the two velocities of the line, how aspherical you need the shape to be, is very close to one for each of the epochs, and all of these epochs are statistically independent. I've shown here in the reddish contours the constraints from the EPM, so it's just to say that these two frameworks are entirely different ways of thinking about this problem, and somewhat orthogonal in logic, but they give the same answer. And if I put them side by side, it becomes very apparent, you know, this is the EPM idea and this is the line shape idea, and if we plot the EPM on the y-axis and the line shape on the x-axis, they both seem to suggest that epsilon, the asymmetry index, is very, very close to zero. Maybe there's a trend across epochs. Maybe there's a trend that they're moving slightly away from zero towards prolate. It's hard to really distinguish because as you go deeper into the ejecta, it becomes more and more tenuous to call this a black body. But the underlying idea is really this here. And as we lay out in the paper, this is just really our findings. We didn't expect to get a spherical explosion. It is somewhat unintuitive to us. But I'm going to add a few ongoing reflections on how we can think about this problem moving forward and what's left to do. So first of all, one could worry that there is something biased in this analysis. Maybe strontium was never a good indicator. And so we've actually been searching through the spectrum and we've found another line within the spectrum. And at around 750 nanometers, there's this really nice feature of a wiggle with, you know, an absorption trough next to an emission peak. Now, this is at later times than the epochs I've been showing you before. This is 4 or 5 days after the merger, 6 days after the merger even. But the point is here that wiggle is telling us about the spectral line of some kind of element. And indeed, we actually think in the paper that we've just submitted that this is the second identification of an R process element so far. That is the identification of yttrium, which is nice not only because it's immediately next to strontium, so it has to be there kind of from nuclear synthesis calculations, but it's also very, very nice because it has some energy transitions that lie at just the right spot for it to create a feature at around 750 nanometers. It's the 42 to the 45p transitions in the electron shell. And the thing that I just want you to take away right now is that this line has a fixed central wavelength because we know what the resonance lines of yttrium is. It also has a strength to the line, and the strength of that line is uniquely predicated by the relative lines from strontium and yttrium. So that is not actually a free parameter. And so the neat thing is the only freedom it has is what is the wavelength stratification of this line? And as it turns out, it's very, very consistent with the wavelength stratification of strontium, meaning that this line is telling us the same velocity as strontium. So now all of a sudden, if we want this sphericity to be coincidental or an artifact of the data, we not only have to be a coincidence scenario of the lines receding inwards in the ejecta at exactly the same rate as the thermalization radius of the black body. We don't only need it to be a coincidence in each of the five statistically independent data sets. We need to do that at different wavelengths of different lines probing different opacities. So it becomes very hard to argue that this sphericity is merely a coincidence scenario, but at least something that we're very curious about. Another idea that I want to highlight is this idea of, let's go back to thinking about how do we actually model our way into sphericity. The fundamental problem here is, right, we're dealing perhaps with far too much angular momentum. The complexity of the system might make it hard to see. I've included these models by Oliver Just here to show you some examples of how you could actually generate a more spherical explosion. The most obvious reason that we thought of in the original Nature paper was the fact that, okay, if If it started out as an aspherical explosion, but I inject a lot of energy into the system, that energy will puff it up. It will sphericalize the explosion and will look like a spherical shell. And indeed that works. And if you add something like 10, 20, 30 MeVs baryons, you could get a spherical explosion. Now that's an uncomfortably large number because it's more energy than you'd get from, you know, the radioactive heating. So it's not coming from these R process elements, these heaviest elements radioactively decaying. You need to put some energy system, and what physically makes that energy, you know, what happens on the transition from two neutron stars to a black hole is something that we just don't really understand. And there are mechanisms to suggest that you could put energy in there, but they're all very kind of hand-wavy and out there. Another option is, of course, that the sphericity that we're observing is just an artifact of the outer layers, right? We can only probe the early epochs when this is very bright. So we're only watching the outer shells of the ejecta, and there might be deeper anisotropies hiding within, as somewhat maybe hinted in the plot I showed before. And if that's the case, one could imagine that this is simply, you know, a jet that's kind of choked, that kind of outpaces all the slower anisotropic ejecta. And so the outermost layer of this matter being thrown out looks very close to zero. Those are at least two options. I kind of encourage you to ponder about whether you think of a smarter one, because really we couldn't find a satisfying answer to put in the Nature paper. And I think it was somewhat odd to write that it was a surprise to us, and we don't really have a good answer for how you get robustly this answer first. I want to say one last idea, and I know it's going to sound maybe a bit heretical or maybe too silly or sensitive to systematics. But it's this statement, right? If this explosion truly is spherical, and we truly can infer the emitting area of this thing because we can infer the velocity of the line, well, then it has an intrinsic luminosity to it that's very easy to model, and that means it's a very nice standard candle. You know the geometry, then you can infer the luminosity, and then you infer the distance, you infer H0. And as it turns out, for our case, it seems to be suggesting that when we're in this regime of the geometry being very well constrained, the dominant contribution to your uncertainty and distance is going to be a peculiar velocity modeling, i.e. how fast is the galaxy, just uncertainty in how fast it's the Hubble flow is actually expanding between us and it. And so this seems to suggest that we're in this regime where these neutron star collisions could be really excellent probes of cosmic distance. For this object, we could try to go for H0 with it. Our calculations show that you get an H0 at 67.1 plus or minus 3.5. Now, the peculiar velocity uncertainty is so large that that's not a super interesting number. It's consistent both with Planck and Ries. But it is at least tentative, right? Because the uncertainty is so much dominated by peculiar velocity that the next kilonova we're going to measure is presumably, given the volume, going to be far further away. And when it's far further away, the relative uncertainty in the peculiar velocity has to go down, which means that future kilonova will be really nice standard candles to measure cosmic distances. And so what I'm showing you here in the last plot is this idea that depending on the distance, you kind of get this very, very well constrained estimate of distance to these objects. And if that's true, you could, in theory, with 5 or 10 of these objects, if they were all spherical, caveat, measure H0 to below 1% precision. And I think that's a bit heretical, but I think it's fun to leave with something crazy. And this is kind of the overall story. If you want to, the paper is out. It's been out for a month and a half, and here's the link on archive. And then I think I can just take questions from now on. I think I may have talked a bit fast, but it was fun.
Thank you. Other questions? So I have one question. Sure. Any questions from online?
Hi, thank you, Juan. Thank you for the nice talk. It was great. I have a couple of questions. The first one is, I understand that these spectral features are not obvious to interpret, and there may be alternative explanations to this. So I think there's an idea that instead of strontium, this could be some feature of helium. Can you comment a little bit on that? Is it relevant for this calculation?
Yeah, that's a really exciting question. And one that that's really nice, actually. And yes, there's been some discussion whether, because helium also has lines that are very strong around 1 micron, right? Fundamentally, it wouldn't really change the logic of this expanding photosphere method argument I had, because the whole point is that the absorption trough and emission peak are well constrained. And so because the helium lines are located at this almost same wavelength as the strontium lines, you get the same characteristic photospheric velocity. So it doesn't really matter what you identified as. The only thing that's important here is that you identify as a feature, as an absorption trough emission peak.
Right.
So it's not a BDD. The argument about trying to constrain the line shape, that is going to be sensitive to exactly how you know these lines blend together and how much each contribute. And so that would be more tentative. But the first part, that's not sensitive to the identification as such.
I see. Yeah, great. So the second question is, you use a measure of how you deviate from spherical symmetry, basically defining two different velocities, right? I'm not sure. Can you like add a, if you have a very irregular ejecta, does it still make sense to use just two? What happens if you add, you know, some additional measure of this, deviations from spherical symmetry that is not just basically an elliptic shape, you know what I mean? Like,
that's a really good question. And the point is, I guess you can keep modeling your way out of it. So you can add epicycles here, right? And add to the complexity. So this analysis is somewhat simplified, right? You start with a spherical and then you make it ellipsoidal and you see how much you need to deviate the ellipsoid and you return to the spherical answer. And as such, you could try to imagine, okay, I'll make a cocoon of matter and a disk around it and kind of increase the complexity. I guess it's a matter of the data doesn't require a much more complicated answer. Nicolas Vieira has this really nice paper that came out a few months ago about this kind of canonical idea that is in kilonova that you do, you know, multi-component modeling, that there's a red kilonova and a blue kilonova and you kind of do a linear combination, maybe there's a purple kilonova in between, that I can, like, I definitely recommend. And I think the overall takeaway is just, yes, you can add complexity, but the data really does not require it at this point. The question is how far away you want to go in perturbations of geometry. And of course, at some level, you could invent an increasingly complex one. And I think at that point, I'll just do Occam's razor. But you're right, that's kind of a weakness of the framework here.
I see. That makes sense. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Great questions.
Thank you, Albert. I have a question. So can you go back? You showed a spectra, I think, of a supernova that wasn't showing that much agreement with a black body.
Yes. Yes, 1999 EM. I think I pulled it from a Vogel paper or Stuart Sim.
Let's see. Right. If a spherical expansion model is going to work, I mean, it would be perhaps more easy to expect that it would manifest itself in a supernova more readily than by a merger. And yet,
certainly. This is also, I think this is a really hard thing to understand, right? So the binary is so inherently asymmetrical to begin with, but a core collapse supernovae, I mean, that seems like you'd get something very spherical to begin with. The argument here was more an argument on why you don't really need to care about the deviations from a black body that much, and that those systematics are small. The argument of why, and actually this is a really interesting question that I've been trying to read up on recently, that when people have observed these anisotropies in the core collapse supernovae, in the case of the binary supernova case, people also have observed this kind of surprising degree of spherism. And I don't think there's a great answer to that. So why why you end up in this answer that in these very kind of weird densities in a very asymmetrical system you go towards heuristic, it doesn't seem to be exclusively a problem for the neutron stars. I think that's also a problem for the binary white dwarf or white dwarf Anna companion.
I see. Thanks. So, yeah. So, in addition to the finding a way to put enough energy in the system so it gets called spherical, you also think that simulation shows there is a significant asymmetry on the characteristics of the ejector, as in the neutral richness of the ejector in the direction of observation. So, you also need to address that, right? Wouldn't you have to kind of make it more homogeneous for the model to work, but it for be consistent with the observations that you're putting forward and this EPM model?
Yeah, so you're right. This is a question of, so not only the EPM analysis is a comparison of the continuum opacity, right? Which isn't, I mean, that's a convolution of the density and the opacity of the individual atoms. But if I'm saying that the strontium itself looks very spherically distributed, that's a weird statement to have in terms of the you know expected angular dependence of the YE of the electron fraction. So that's somewhat interesting. How would you get a mixing of the layers angularly to get the strontium distribution itself to be spherical? Since the paper came out, Andreas Bauswein in Germany made a rather fun simulation showing that it seems like strontium might just be very spherically distributed even when YE is aspherical. But you're right that the two frameworks, one is talking about continuum opacity and one is talking very specifically about the opacity of one element, that they both show sphericity is kind of telling you something about the elemental abundance with angle as well.
Thank you, great talk.
Any other questions? Well, if not, let's thank Al for the day. So, thank you.